The Myth of Mental Illness, Foundations of a Theory of Personal Conduct, by Thomas Sasse. HarperCollins, 2011, 372 pages, 263 summarized. A brief book summary from Books at a Glance, by Benjamin J. Montoya, Ph.D. Editor's Note. Again, we offer a bonus book summary that falls outside the usual field of biblical and theological studies. Thomas Sasse sought in his works to expose the problems of contemporary psychology, and we thought his work would be of interest to our readers. About the author. Thomas S. Sasse, M.D., 1920-2012, was an academic, psychiatrist, and psychoanalyst. He served for the most of his career as professor of psychiatry at the State University of New York Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. His works also include The Manufacture of Madness. Introduction. Despite the common use of the term mental illness, the term itself is as contradictory as calling someone a married bachelor. When considering what an illness is compared to the current expanded definition of mental illness, it becomes clear that the definition of an illness was expanded to even allow for the creation of this misnomer. If that is the case, then a new understanding of mental illness needs to replace it, given the ongoing occurrence of something that seems to fall outside of the realm of standard illness. Enter Thomas Sasse's Theory of Personal Conduct. Table of Contents. Introduction. Part 1. The Myth of Mental Illness. Section 1. Growth and Structure of the Myth. Chapter 1. Charcot and the Problem of Hysteria. Chapter 2. Illness and Counterfeit Illness. Chapter 3. The Social Context of Medical Practice. Section 2. Hysteria, an Example of the Myth. Chapter 4. Breuer and Freud's Studies on Hysteria. Chapter 5. Hysteria and Psychosomatic Medicine. Chapter 6. Contemporary Views of Hysteria and Mental Illness. Part 2. Foundations of a Theory of Personal Conduct. Section 3. Semiotical Analysis of Behavior. Chapter 7. Language and Proto-Language. Chapter 8. Hysteria as Communication. Section 4. Rule-Following Analysis of Behavior. Chapter 9. The Rule-Following Model of Human Behavior. Chapter 10. The Ethics of Helplessness and Helpfulness. Chapter 11. Theology, Witchcraft, and Hysteria. Section 5. Game Model Analysis of Behavior. Chapter 12. The Game-Playing Model of Human Behavior. Chapter 13. Hysteria as a Game. Chapter 14. Impersonation and Illness. Chapter 15. The Ethics of Psychiatry. Conclusion. Epilogue. Summary. Appendix 1. Mental Illness is Still a Myth. Appendix 2. Defining Disease. Summary. Part 1. The Myth of Mental Illness. Section 1. Growth and Structure of the Myth. Chapter 1. Charcot and the Problem of Hysteria. Jean-Martin Charcot, 1825 to 1893, was a neurologist and neuropathologist whose work had led to the problem of conflating mental illness with actual illness. He was interested in studying people with problematic behaviors and mental states, much like a biologist might study a dissected frog. The goal was to learn, classify, and label what they were seeing. In his day, people with these kinds of struggles often had nowhere to turn, unlike today. Charcot's work has been largely criticized and shown to be highly problematic and even faked in some instances. But his prestige as a scientist helps his ideas live well beyond the grave. Charcot helped tie in the concept that mental illness, or hysteria, was part of the larger field of medical illnesses. But herein lies a core double standard in psychiatry that still persists. On the one hand, they want to include their field of study under this larger umbrella. If they do that, they quickly realize the unnecessary role they play. If those of the phenomena are truly illnesses, then people need to be referred to physicians. But on the other hand, they still want to have a hand in holding that umbrella, in a way of speaking, so that they can speak, study, and treat said individuals instead of relinquishing their role to physicians. Chapter 2. Illness and Counterfeit Illness. Physicians have extremely difficult tasks before them. They have to diagnose conditions properly and be aware of symptoms that may not actually be what people are claiming. Someone may say they have a pain, pointing to a certain medical condition that may not, in fact, be what they think. So then, physicians have to be able to observe certain phenomena and provide an accurate label and classification so they can treat what they are seeing. Modern psychiatry's ongoing attempt to classify mental health issues, hysteria, as medical illnesses creates ongoing issues because one is not part of the other. Until Charcot, illnesses were only considered such if they were bodily illnesses requiring a medical doctor. With the current expanded definition, counterfeit illnesses that do not require a medical doctor but a psychiatrist, the myth of mental illness is only further propounded. Some will argue that the end justifies the means, saying the social rehabilitation of criminals justifies calling a non-illness as an illness. It, however, is a mistake from the perspective of intellectual integrity and scientific progress to deliberately misrepresent these phenomena as mental illness. Sure, it lends credence to the field of modern psychiatry, but no help is actually provided in lying to society at large by this modern expansion of the definition of illness to incorporate non-illnesses. Chapter 3. The Social Context of Medical Practice. In ages past, if people sought medical treatment, they had two avenues: private practices or what was available to the poor. The former was reserved for the wealthy, whereas the latter sought whatever they could get as a form of charity. This social context has transformed. With the birth of medical insurance, now insurance companies have some measure of input and control as to what they will pay after the physician prescribes something. Furthermore, it has been revealed that medications, therapeutic inventions, have and continue to serve two purposes. First, doctors aim to heal the sick. If someone has a true bodily illness, the doctor does his or her best to prescribe something that will help them improve. Second, and more horrifically, modern medicine, especially psychiatry, has become a form of control. It would be a mistake to throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater, trying to reject the larger medical practice altogether, because helping people heal and improve still matters. But these historical realities require people to be discriminate between the larger purposes at play. Section 2. Hysteria, an example of the myth. Chapter 4. Brewer and Freud's studies on hysteria. Brewer and Freud's studies on hysteria only further illustrate the problems highlighted to this point. On the one hand, they studied the phenomena they saw, but they were careful to use language that made it clear that what they saw differed from what a physician would treat. But they continued to discuss and include their views on people's struggles with hysteria as if it were part of medical issues. Doing so landed them in a kind of second-class citizenship in the land of science, which is what they wanted. But the development of the psychoanalytic theory of hysteria developed. They made observations about how these matters can manifest themselves into physiological ways, as if the so-called jump from the psychic into the organic can happen. This is altogether false. But as history has shown, just because something is untrue doesn't mean it does not become influential, as their research continues to be influential, despite being well known as problematic. Chapter 5. Hysteria and Psychosomatic Medicine. Part of the underlying difficulty arises from the very conception of hysteria and how to diagnose and prescribe medicine in these instances. The problem lies in the very language used to include mental illness, hysteria, within the realm of other bodily or somatic illnesses. Doing so would technically require other kinds of treatment, but it is not that treatment that is being offered. How, then, should this relationship be conceived? Instead of viewing this as an illness that a physician or psychiatrist needs to treat, the language that more appropriately fits what is happening is that of a translation. For example, if someone speaking Hungarian comes into an Englishman's physician's office, then someone would need to learn the other language or hire a translator to comprehend what was actually being said. This is a better linguistic description of what should be happening in modern psychiatry, as opposed to the ongoing misuse of language and classification. Chapter 6. Contemporary Views of Hysteria and Mental Illness. Contemporary views of hysteria and mental illness fall into two broad categories. The first is that of the school of thought, from Freud's psychoanalytic model described in the aforementioned chapters. This Freud's approach has gained widespread social acceptance in contemporary America, despite its problematic nature. The second model consists of organic theories, claiming mental illnesses are brain diseases. Such, then, advocates argue as follows. From the results of this investigation, it seems proper to suggest that the diagnosis of hysteria might be made by following the standard procedure used in the general field of diagnostic medicine, that is, determining the facts of the chief complaint, past history, physical examination, and laboratory investigation. If the relevant symptoms of hysteria are known, this method can be applied by any physician without the use of special techniques, dream analysis, or prolonged investigation or psychological conflicts. The ongoing issue with both camps is that they do not speak the same language and do not have the same interest in mind. Thus, both camps do not have much good to say about the other. Typically, such communication results in one castigating the other instead of seeking to dialogue and learn from the other. Part 2. Foundations of a Theory of Personal Conduct. Section 3. Semiotical Analysis of Behavior. Chapter 7. Language and Proto-Language. To work toward a theory of personal conduct, a starting point is considering the use of language, in this case, stemming from an understanding of semiotics. The concept of language, sign, and symbol find themselves to be useful. This proto-language is important because people use language as a sign to symbolize something for some kind of purpose. For example, a professor may write something on the board to encourage students to learn something so they pass the course. In the same way, when someone struggling with some kind of hysteria meets with a physician or a psychiatrist, they are using language as a sign to say, "Help me." So then, semantics gives way to pragmatics. Certainly, there remains an informative aspect to the use of this language. But the promotive aspect, such as a GPS telling someone to turn right, is still in play. This kind of symbolization can have at least two types. It can be similarity and causative. Like how a slap in the face results in the pain of facial neuralgia, and how pain from the slap is the cause of further pain. Chapter 8. Hysteria as Communication. To reframe the discussion of hysteria away from an illness that requires treatment, the very language used must be reconceptualized. That is, the language of a physician treating a disease ought to be jettisoned altogether. For example, if an English speaker met a French speaker, the Englishman would not think that the French speaker has a disease because they speak a different language. Instead, they would seek to translate what the other is saying so they can communicate. The mistake of Freud and the like is that when people refused to agree with his interpretations, he labeled them as resistant to treatment. It is because that disease-physician paradigm is at play in his analysis. Instead, if we understand hysteria as a form of communication, the discussion is placed within a different paradigm, such that treating is not the goal. It then becomes a matter of improving communication and personal conduct, instead of using some kind of mysterious pseudo-medical explanation for these occurrences of hysteria. Section 4. Rule Following Analysis of Behavior. Chapter 9. The Rule Following Model of Human Behavior. One understanding of human behavior is that of rule following. People are taught to follow rules at a very young age for a wide variety of reasons and purposes. Rules can be understood in several ways. 1. Natural laws or biological rules. 2. Prescriptive laws or social, religious, moral rules. 3. Imitative or interpersonal rules. Rules like seen in the Ten Commandments are more obvious rules designed to prevent certain behaviors. However, children are often taught to imitate certain behaviors and settings to help them behave appropriately. How we understand each of these categories of rules depends on an awareness and understanding of the meta-rules, and that implies an understanding of the origin, function, and scope of the lower-level rules. The mere fact that people can be aware of a larger meta-rule attitude, so to speak, enables people to be aware of and decide if the lower-level rules are worth complying with or of trying to change. Chapter 10. The Ethics of Helplessness and Helpfulness. The expression of hysteria is a cry for help that is best understood as a progression from people's upbringing as their growth to self-reflection and awareness develop. To understand this development, a broader understanding of helplessness and helpfulness require consideration from a variety of backgrounds. For example, psychiatrists, psychologists, and social scientists tend to avoid examining the values and rules of the Judeo-Christian religions. These religions are filled with rules, some of which may lend themselves to dependency and helplessness, as if both were to be rewarded. In certain situations, these rules prescribe when man, subject, son, patient, is healthy, independent, rich, and proud. Then God, king, father, physician, shall be strict with him and punish him. But should man be sick, dependent, poor, and humble, then God shall care for him and protect him. It might seem that I have exaggerated this rule. I do not believe so. Rather, this impression reflects our spontaneous antagonism to such a rule when it is clearly and forcefully stated. Therapists have the same call to be helpful that parents have for helpless newborns. Disabled adults fall into that same category of being considered helpless, requiring help. To improve the level of helpfulness, these kinds of religious, cultural, legal, and family rules require consideration. Chapter 11. Theology, Witchcraft, and Hysteria. The situation with hysteria, and it being characterized as a mental illness, is the same situation that happened in the Middle Ages with religion and witchcraft. When examining the witchcraft trials, it became apparent that the scapegoats in these trials may not, in fact, have been practicing sorcery. They likely struggled with some kind of hysteria and were labeled as witches or sorceries instead of anything else happening. When they were publicly punished or killed, it served as a warning to others who might behave in a similar manner. This was a sad game of control practiced by religious leaders of that day. Heresy, or disagreement with the church's established teaching, was treated in the same way. Ironically, contemporary intellectuals scoff at religion and witchcraft today, but they hesitate to do the same toward the modern treatment of the so-called mentally ill. But the comparison remains important. In the Middle Ages, to suggest that heresy was a different way of life, as today suggesting that mental illness is another way of life, would both be met with the same look of absurdity, or worse. Section 5. Game Model Analysis of Behavior. Chapter 12. The Game-Playing Model of Human Behavior. The idea that human behavior can be described as a game model was first clearly articulated by George Herbert Mead. He understood all human behavior to be interpreted with this analogy. It would be easy to misuse this analogy, creating a distinction between primary and secondary gains, in which hysteria could still be considered as something that needs to be treated, thus regressing back to the previous understandings and making this understanding quite useless. But removing the distinction between primary and secondary gains alleviates the problem in toto. Human behavior as game playing recognizes four stages. One, the earliest stage is imitation of a child seeing and mimicking other behaviors. Two, the second stage is when the child receives codified rules. Three, the third stage occurs when children begin to question the mutual control and unification of rules. Four, the fourth stage is characterized by codification of rules. The utility of this concept is from the reality that most people know how to play games. So, reframing the discussion of human behavior in this way lends itself to a broader understanding and also removes potential misunderstandings. As people get older, they begin to understand meta-rules that governs the lower rules for playing the game of human behavior. People began to form their own conceptions of what those look like, just as various tennis players would offer different suggestions for how to play tennis best. Chapter 13, Hysteria as a Game. Hysteria is more properly viewed as playing a game instead of an illness that needs to be treated. What is happening when someone experiences hysteria is that they are playing a game of charades of sorts, trying to communicate to others, family members, physicians, or psychiatrists, what is going on with them, trying to translate or convert the language into ordinary language. The solution for people struggling with hysteria is changing the game-playing behavior, not seeking a cure because this behavior does not fall into that category. The usual characteristics of game-playing find themselves in behavior too. People need to be able to make real choices, as in a chess game. There also remains a level of uncertainty as to who will win, and people seek to enact control in game-playing with behavior as with elsewhere. Unfortunately, lying is commonplace among people with hysteria, as in game-playing. It is not as though that needs to be condoned. Rather, an awareness of what is at play when someone lies is important. They may lie because they are scared in a given situation. Chapter 14, Impersonation and Illness. Keeping with the analogy of behavior as game-playing, impersonation comes into consideration. Impersonation has both positive and negative elements. On the one hand, children learn to impersonate others as they determine how to behave in a given context. This is not bad. People need to learn to take on certain roles. But on the other hand, impersonation can have a negative role, like someone lying to a judge or impersonating some kind of mental illness to avoid being in prison. That is an element of psychiatry that has not been properly addressed. This condition is known as Ganser syndrome. But this instance shows that there is not real syndrome. It is a form of game playing to achieve control in a situation that one would otherwise have none. Impersonation also plays a central role in ascertaining the role psychiatrists and psychotherapists have played in a medical role that they do not have a right to play. Hysteria is not an illness. So the proverbial emperor is found to have no clothes in this situation. They are just impersonating, not actually legitimately in that role, despite the powerful role that social institutions of medicine and psychiatry play. Chapter 15, The Ethics of Psychiatry. Ethics matter tremendously for psychiatry because of the various roles they can play. They can play at least three. One, psychiatrists can be theoretical scientists or ethicists. Two, they can also be seen as applied scientists or ethicists. Three, psychiatrists can also act as social engineers or controllers of social deviance. There are two larger categories that can be used to describe psychiatric intervention, either voluntary or involuntary. Their role in helping people who struggle with hysteria can be involuntary, and that is where it crosses an ethical line. It is important to keep an open and critical mind when psychiatrists get involved, because just because something is regarded as an official form of medical treatment does not mean it is ethical. More positively speaking, the ethics of psychiatry should be to work towards helping people who struggle with hysteria make better choices as they seek to play the larger game of life. Copyright 2025, Books at a Glance. Books at a Glance book summaries are available by subscription only, and except for brief quotes, may not be reproduced in whole or in part without express written permission.